You may be seated. Good morning. Our next case is 2015-381, City of Cleveland versus Tressant D. Jones. For Mr. Jones, Mr. Sweeney.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Colin Sweeney and David Eidemiller on behalf of Mr. Jones. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case about finality and the prosecution's ability to disturb a final verdict entered by a trial court. Over 2 years ago, Mr. Jones pled no contest to a criminal complaint, to all four counts of a criminal complaint. The trial court accepted the plea and then proceeded to find him guilty of some counts, not guilty of others. The city prosecutor at the time did not object to the verdict, and
he did not agree to the amended charge, did he?
The prosecutor did not want to amend the charge, and that's the reason Mr. Jones pled no contest to the complaint as is. There was no amendment by the city. And so the only thing the city said at the time is they wanted to make clear that there was no amendment by the city, and the judge made it clear to their satisfaction. Ultimately,
she amended the complaint.
She did not amend the complaint. She entered a verdict after a no contest plea. I mean, that ultimately is a threshold disagreement between the parties.
Does there need to be a colloquy between the court and the accused?
Pursuant to Traffic Rule 10D, which is what applies to this case, the only requirement is to explain the effect of a no contest plea to the defendant.
Was that done?
It was done. The question was whether there was substantial compliance in this case, because it was a perfunctory explanation for sure. But one of the issues that ultimately the 8th District reversed this case, at least in part, on the basis that they felt that the plea colloquy was incomplete. But that was inappropriate for a couple of reasons. Number one, because the whole point of the plea colloquy is to ensure that the defendant knows what he's doing or she's doing. It's not an issue that can be sua sponte raised by the Court of Appeals, and that's what they did here. They vacated a plea on a basis that the city wasn't even asking them to vacate it. They weren't making any arguments about the validity of the plea. And ultimately, Judge Gallagher, in his concurring opinion, determined that the plea proceeding was void because the colloquy was insufficient. Now, there's no case law to support that conclusion, and I would submit that would wreak havoc on the justice system if you had, any time a plea didn't substantially comply, a criminal defendant, the prosecution, the Court of Appeals could challenge and vacate that plea at any time. That's the sum and substance and effect of the 8th District's decision. In this case, so as a threshold matter, one of the disagreements is over whether there was a pre-plea amendment or whether the defendant pled no contest to the original complaint. And if you look at the record, which is short, what it says, the prosecutor makes clear that she is unwilling to amend the complaint. Defense counsel says he's going to change his plea to no contest, and then at that point, the court enters its verdict and makes clear that their finding on count one is to physical control rather than DUI, and that the defendant was not guilty of the second DUI and then was guilty of DUS and also the Mark Lanes violation. And when the city appealed,
all right, let me ask you a question there. Your position would be that after there was a no contest plea, the judge rightfully then rendered a decision on the two counts, correct?
On four counts,
four
yes.
Four counts, but dismissed the driving under the influence, correct?
The second count found not guilty in its entirety.
Not guilty. Okay. So, on what basis?
You mean what factual grounds?
Yes. What factual grounds were put before her that would have allowed for that result?
Your Honor, in this case, the trial court is empowered in a municipal case in 2937.07 to render a verdict of guilty or not guilty based on no contest plea. It's no different than a judge entering a Rule 29 or rendering a verdict after a bench trial.
Well, wait a minute. After a bench trial, after Rule 29, you're going to have some evidence in front of you that you're going to be able to make an informed decision as according to your oath as a judge, correct? What did this judge have before her?
She had the statements of the trooper who explained what happened during the traffic stop. And I will point out that the city didn't ask to put any other evidence in. They didn't say, well, you know, Your Honor, before you render your verdict, we'd like to also offer you more testimony or more statements on this.
Well, I mean, the drifting over the lanes, et cetera, he was verbally combative, that he smelled the odor of alcohol. He had glassy, bloodshot eyes. He stumbled, you know, on the roadside. The nystagmus test, I think, was administered. Am I correct on that?
There was a pen test that was at least partially administered.
Okay, so there was indicia that your client was impaired. And his response was, I wasn't drunk at all, I was just upset.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think, first of all, we're missing the most important issue in this case, which is that the state has no right to get to this kind of inquiry that we're engaged in here, which is second-guessing a final verdict of a trial court, whether correct or incorrect. And that's what this court has held consistently in a unanimous decision in State X Rel Sawyer. The case is almost identical. Same facts, same charge. The judge found the defendant guilty of what they viewed as a lesser offense. And this court unanimously held that 2945.67, which limits the state's ability to appeal from a final verdict, precluded any appeal on whether or not the verdict was correct or incorrect. The state has limited appellate rights. They have no rights without the statute. The statute gives them the rights to appeal everything by leave of court except the final verdict.
Well, there was leave of court. There was leave of court granted to appeal, though, was there not?
That's correct. We argued in the 8th District that the case should have been dismissed because they were appealing the final verdict.
Yes, but the appellate court granted the state leave to appeal.
Yes, they did.
And the state didn't challenge the final verdict, did it?
Well, they were challenging the final verdict. They were saying the defendant could not be convicted of physical control. The trial court got it wrong when they did it.
Although, counsel, the trial court doesn't enter a verdict. The verdict's only for a jury. Does that make a difference? The finding here was of guilt and guilty and not guilty, which is not a verdict. And
well, I don't. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So I just wanted to clarify that with you.
I don't think it makes a difference. First of all, this court's controlling precedent, State X Rel Sawyer, was exactly the same circumstance. They call it a finding of guilty or finding of not guilty in the statute, which to me is a verdict. Whether you call it that or you call it a finding of guilty or not guilty, it's still the judge making a determination. And when you look at that statute, it says you make a determination based on an explanation of the circumstances. The question of whether this trial court judge made the right call or the wrong call is something that the state simply cannot appeal. And so in this case, the state's not left totally without a remedy, because with respect to this criminal defendant, it's fine. He can't be retried. It's over. But they can take a Bistricky appeal, which allows them to challenge substantive legal rulings associated with the case. They can get, as they did in State X Rel Sawyer, you know, in a sense, an advisory opinion on what the trial court did. But in this case, the defendant went through all the steps of exposing himself to a conviction on all four counts, being found guilty of some, not guilty of others. He was sentenced, he served his sentence, and now the state wants to go back and re-prosecute him. So there's three things that prevent the state from doing that. The first is that they don't have a right to appeal it under 2945.67.
Would this be a conviction in your judgment?
It is a conviction, yes.
So could it be vacated for failure of the trial court to advise him of the effect of a no contest plea?
Only if that issue is raised by the criminal defendant.
Can it be raised in the future?
No. No, Your Honor. Because what's clear, one thing that's clear is errors.
So when we have people charged with OVI and they go back and say, I have four or five priors in the last 20 years, but one of them was uncounseled, or one of them was defective because the court failed to advise me what it was of all of my rights. why are those cases not analogous to this case?
Those cases are totally, the two examples you gave are totally different. One, being uncounseled and not having a knowing waiver constitutes a constitutional violation that this court has deemed can't be an enhancement.
I'm talking about the fact that the plea might not be in compliance with what Rule 10 says should be done by the trial court, which not done here.
Right. With respect to that issue, the court has regularly held that those issues are res judicata. That's a voidable issue that has to be raised on direct appeal. I can tell you from experience, because I've tried raising that issue.
Sure you can.
and the court, when it's an issue that's apparent in the record, if you're saying the trial court did not comply with Traffic Rule 10, you have to raise that on direct appeal.
Well, counsel, why would the defendant raise that here? And isn't that a right of the defendant to raise? He got treated pretty well in below.
He absolutely would not raise it, and he did not raise it.
So does the state have the right to say, Judge, you didn't advise this client, this defendant, of all his rights, and you just gave him a pretty lenient sentence, and we'd like to have that vacated so you can have a do-over?
Well, you know, first of all, the state could point out to the trial court that they didn't comply with Traffic Rule 10. They certainly could do that. They didn't make any mention of that in this case. The state could have said prior to sentencing, Your Honor, we would like to present more explanation of circumstances because we don't think you have the full picture of what happened here. They didn't do that. But what they can't do is appeal once the defendant has been sentenced, there's a verdict or a finding of guilt, and then seek to re-prosecute them. And that brings us a little bit into the double jeopardy issues that really this court does not have to wade into because first of all, the state doesn't have a right to appeal. Secondly, the Eighth District got it wrong when they said that the plea was void. And so it could be resolved on those grounds. But if you get to the double jeopardy issue, he also can't be re-prosecuted on double jeopardy grounds. The Attorney General who argued mostly about double jeopardy did not point to a single case where a defendant has pled no contest, been sentenced, and then was able to be re-prosecuted. And the U.S. Supreme Court, though, it hasn't defined precisely when jeopardy terminates in the context of a no contest plea, clearly the sentence is that point in time. And so there's a lot of cases from this court where if the state wants to challenge something that the trial court does, they have rights of interlocutory appeal. That's what they did in State versus Malinowski, one of the cases that they rely on, but is different. It was during a trial. They were challenging an evidentiary ruling prior to verdict and sentence, and they got a ruling. What they can't do is appeal after the final verdict. The General Assembly has made that clear. And double jeopardy makes clear that they can't be retried after they've exposed themselves to conviction on all four counts. And that's what Mr. Jones did in this case. The Attorney General relied on Ohio versus Johnson and says that this court has to revisit Sawyer.
Mr. Sweeney, a no contest plea is an admission of the truth of the allegations alleged in the complaint. Correct?
Yes, a no contest plea is an admission of the facts alleged in the complaint. Correct.
And then once those facts are admitted, how does a judge make a finding other than the facts that are alleged, and how can the judge make a finding on a lesser but included, I'm not even sure if physical control is an offense in the state of Ohio, but it's what happened here.
Okay.
How does the judge get there if, in fact, the accused has admitted to the offense of OVI?
Well, misdemeanor offenses are unique in that way. And 2937.07 is the statute that governs. And it makes clear, and this court made clear in City of Cuyahoga Falls versus Bowers, that the defendant, by pleading no contest, empowers the court to render a verdict of guilt or not guilt based on an, quote, explanation of the circumstances.
But
was
there an explanation of the circumstances here after the lawyer said that his client would plead no contest.
Explanation of the circumstances.
And the accused never said anything.
The trial court referred to what was said before by the trooper as the explanation of circumstances. Yes. But no, there was no further. But again, the city didn't say, Judge, you know what? We'd like to put on more evidence now that he's changed his plea to no contest. They didn't ask to do it. And City of Cuyahoga Falls versus Bowers makes clear
that doesn't help your argument, though, does it? The trooper testified the odor of alcohol, the unsteady on the feet, inability to do the, I think, the stand of one of the tests. He couldn't do it because of traffic. That doesn't help your argument, does it?
Your Honor, the question is not whether you seven would reach the same conclusion as the trial court on the verdict here. You're not sitting as finders of fact as the trial court was.
I guess I'm following Justice O'Donnell's question. What evidence was before that court to find not guilty?
Well, that's my point is, well, first of all, he said I wasn't drinking. So there was that evidence. There's a difference of opinion between the trooper and the defendant. The defendant says I was agitated because I was stopped. I wasn't drinking. So there was evidence. But secondly, again, whether or not the trial court reached the correct finding, this court in a unanimous decision in Sawyer said that the trial court grossly abused its discretion in its view in reaching the conclusion that they was not guilty of OVI and guilty of reckless operation. This court still found because it's not the General Assembly has made clear that whether or not the trial court makes the right verdict or the wrong verdict, which is exactly what they're challenging in this case, is not to be reviewed by a court of appeals or the Supreme Court. The question is not whether the trial court made the right or the wrong call. The question is whether the state has the right to appeal in this circumstance, and they do not. So with that being said, what we would ask this court to do is to apply State versus Sawyer, which is directly on point, and reverse the 8th District, and most specifically, reverse the 8th District's determination that a court of appeals can sua sponte, vacate a plea.
Well, counsel, one of the arguments that's put forth in the Attorney General's brief was that the statute allows prosecutors to appeal a decision dismissing all or part of the criminal charges as a matter of right, and any decision other than a final verdict with leave of the appellate court. And here they're saying what the judge did by Mr. Jones not guilty after the no contest is the functional equivalent of a decision to dismiss as originally charged.
They are saying that. That is correct. I mean, I disagree. I mean, the judge rendered a verdict, and under 2937.07 is empowered to do just that. It is empowered to render a verdict. When a defendant pleads no contest, that's not a perfunctory exercise at that point. That's what this court said in City of Cuyahoga Falls versus Bowers. The court then determines, based on explanation of the circumstances, whether the defendant's guilty or not guilty. This is different in a misdemeanor case than in a felony case. This is a unique statute that gives the trial court, and I think reflects the General Assembly's recognition that we're dealing with 50, 100 municipal cases every day. We're going to give a little more discretion to the trial court in terms of finding of guilt or not guilt after a no contest plea.
Okay, and the documentation here, there seems to be a discrepancy in what actually was written by the judge on the document.
Well, there's a difference of opinion amongst the three judges below, but the judge makes clear when she's talking to the prosecutor that the prosecutor, she's not indicating that the prosecutor amended it.
But first she said the prosecutor amended.
Well, actually she said in a relatively confusing statement in the same paragraph that the prosecutor amended it and didn't amend it. So, but that's exactly why the prosecutor said, to be clear, and this is on page 18, the city did not amend count one to physical control. And the court said, that's what I'm writing on the journal. Ms. Hopp says, thank you.
And did she write that on the journal?
No, she did not indicate. She wrote, based upon the facts, court finds defendant guilty of physical control. That's what she wrote on the journal. There's a indication of the state revised code that is crossed out under prosecutor amends charge and written up on the top of this handwritten journal entry. There's a reference to the city code for physical control. Nowhere on this does it say the state amended the charge.
So if originally he was charged under the state statute, correct?
With respect to the OVI.
All right, and then she changes it to the city code.
She did, yes.
And that's not an amendment of
the... She found him guilty of what she viewed to be a lesser-included offense.
But under a different statutory scheme.
Well,
a city code as opposed to the revised code.
You can be charged with a violation of the state code and be found guilty of a violation of the revised code as a lesser. I mean, I've had that circumstances come up mm-hmm. in municipal court.
But the statute 293707 never uses the term final verdict. I know you keep saying finding of guilt and finding of not guilty is the same thing, but when the General Assembly uses different terms, they don't necessarily mean the same thing. We're not talking about a final verdict in that statute.
Well, Your Honor, I think we are. For Mr. Jones, we certainly were. I mean, he was found guilty of some offenses and not guilty of others. To me, it's a final verdict, and to this court, it was a final verdict in State X. Rel. Sawyer, when this court unanimously held the city could not appeal it. So
it occurs to me, Mr. Sweeney, that on page 12, the court may have prejudged this because the court says, we're going to hold you accountable for some of this stuff. Let's call it back, but you've got to understand, too. And then the court says at page 13 of the transcript, there are two ways we could go about this. You could either enter a no contest and stipulate to the facts, and we could do a finding. I'm inclined to, as we said on the other side, he's totally responsible for both of the charges, but one, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, however you want to do it. I said, however you want to do it. Had the court prejudged the case before a plea was entered? Because there was no plea at that point.
I would acknowledge that those statements suggest that the judge had made up her mind before, or at least made up part of her mind with respect to some of the charges before the plea was entered. And if the city at that time felt the judge was not in a position to fairly rule,
well, that's
case,
why that's why the city sought leave to appeal the determination of the trial court on the procedural basis of what had occurred at the time that this plea was accepted by the court and the finding was
made. Actually, the city didn't argue there was a prejudgment issue. The only issue they argued was that there was an improper pre-plea amendment. And that's the only issue. And in fact, they only argued it with respect to count one.
I don't find any amendment, either in the court's journal entry or in the transcript.
I agree, there is no amendment.
This was a plea entered by a lawyer on behalf of a client who never spoke, and a finding by a court to something other than a charge, to a lesser offense.
I don't disagree. That's essentially what happened in this case.
Is that what we want going on in our trial courts? I mean, is this going to become precedent now?
Your Honor, if you're asking me, is this the model proceeding, I would say no, it's not. But
how do we direct our trial judges and our trial counsel to conduct proper proceedings?
Well, Your Honor, this in a Bistricky appeal where you're not affecting and forcing the defendant to run the gauntlet twice, you can give whatever direction you feel is appropriate to say, number one, you shouldn't give any indication of what you're going to do.
So what you're suggesting is this was totally inappropriate, but double jeopardy precludes any further proceedings in this case, and anything we do should be directory for future cases. Am I hearing your argument correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this is, I don't know about totally inappropriate, but I don't think if I were the judge, I would offer comments about what I think I'm going to do before the defendant pleads no contest.
What about having the accused respond directly to the trial?
Well, Your Honor, I would also, to ensure that his plea is knowing and voluntary, et cetera, I would ask the accused specifically. But I can tell you that this is not, it's not like this has never happened before where a defendant speaks on behalf of his counsel.
Is this a common practice in your experience, Mr. Sweeney?
Well, having spoken to my co-counsel, it does happen. Is it common that the defendant has no colloquy with the judge? I don't think common would be a fair statement, but it does happen. So, again, I think this is a case with multiple layers. At its most simplest level, I believe it's an appeal from a final verdict that should be dismissed. Mm-hmm. But at another level, there is an issue that this court can address with the plea colloquy and whether it was appropriate or not. But the wrong answer is to vacate a plea These procedural rules are designed to protect the rights of the criminal defendant. It's not for the Court of Appeals to, if they don't agree with the verdict of the trial court, to step in and say, you know what, we think the plea was void.
Mr. Sweeney, you're way over your time, but let's have some more fun. Judge Gallagher suggested it's just simply void.
Right.
But there ought to be a way for prosecutors to appeal, even if jeopardy is attached. Get issues like this resolved.
Yes.
Is that a good answer?
You know, Your Honor, I don't think the courts should be used for, in general, for an exercise in giving advisory opinions. I think judicial trainings are for that. But I don't think that you should take a case and simply to provide an advisory opinion where it's going to make no difference in the outcome of that particular case in general. But I do think that if this court feels it's, I do think that the Eighth District decision has to be reversed, because that idea that a plea is void and could be sua sponte raised by the Court of Appeals is totally without precedent in this state.
But you would agree that if the outcome of this case wasn't such a benefit to your client and he asked you to appeal based on the compliance with Traffic Rule 10, you would have been on firm ground doing that based on the deficient exchange.
You know, Your Honor, honestly, I don't know. We would have raised the issue, but I can tell you that what the answer of the Court of Appeals would have been, look, he sat there silently. He didn't ask for more explanation.
Well,
he acquiesced into what his lawyer said.
I don't think that that's the standard that we go by, that the defendant has the burden of showing that he should have instructed the judge to do a better job.
Well, the standard is substantial compliance, and I have had very little luck appealing pleas on that basis. But be that as it may, whether or not we would have done it, it is the defendant's right to raise noncompliance with the plea.
I understand that. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Hopp?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Bridget Hopp, and I'm representing the City of Cleveland in this matter. Seated with me is Samuel Peterson, author of the amicus brief on behalf of the Ohio Attorney General's Office. I'll be ceding about 3 minutes of my time to him this morning. Your Honors, I think the lead opinion in the 8th District put it the best when it said, in her effort to come to a balance of what happened, the trial court simply took it upon herself to provide Mr. Jones with an unrelated municipal code section as in a way to resolve his case. And that's what happened here.
But counsel, this is an interesting case to me, because I'm going to try and figure out, as the appellee, which of the three Court of Appeals judges do you agree with?
I think I in part agree with all three of them. Of course, I agree with the lead opinion.
But they're saying different things.
I agree with them in different ways.
For example, when Judge Gallagher says it's a void judgment, that would suggest that the trial court didn't have any jurisdiction to entertain this matter at any time, right?
I see that as the court had no authority to amend this charge to a physical control. So in that sense, I do agree with the concurring opinion of Judge Gallagher that the trial court did not have any authority to amend this charge or change this charge to a physical control based upon no facts supporting that charge in the record. And I actually agree with the dissent in that I believe that the journal entry reflects that the city did amend the charge. So in the dissent, Judge Jones does say he would send it.
But I guess from a legal standpoint, I think I'd be a lot more comfortable if just Judge Gallagher said abuse of discretion or without authority. But once they start talking void, they're saying shouldn't have touched this case. Isn't that what void means?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And of course, I would like all the judges in the 8th District to, you know, side on my side a little bit more, maybe say some different things in their opinion. But, you know, as I said, this really what this was the trial court took it upon itself to provide Mr. Jones with this municipal code section of physical control to resolve his case based upon all of these facts that were said at the outset of the hearing.
Well, wait a minute, though. Don't we really have a core question we have to answer here? Does a trial court have the opportunity, when somebody pleads no contest to an OMVI case, say, okay, I've listened to you, I've heard everybody in the room, you're guilty of jaywalking, have a nice day?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Under Revised Code 29-3707, upon a no contest plea, it is an admission of the truth of the facts contained in the complaint. The court then has the ability to find that criminal defendant either guilty or not guilty, following an explanation of the circumstances. And the explanation of circumstances in this case actually happened prior to Mr. Jones's attorney entering a plea of no contest to the charges. But all of those facts, those unsworn statements elicited by the trooper, as well as the prosecutor, do not support any finding of physical control versus OVI. The key point of differentiation between the two is operation here. And there
isn't that, excuse me, counsel, isn't that then an issue that the state can't raise? Then we're getting into, do the facts support a particular verdict? And I think your friends on the other side would say, you don't get that right on appeal. How do you respond to that?
My response is that the trial court, the facts in the record do not support the trial court entering that finding that day, and nothing in the record supports that. And I'm not raising that appeal. I'm simply saying that that day, when the trial court had this hearing, there was nothing said at that hearing that would support any finding of physical control versus OVI. The only thing the defendant was challenging was whether or not, I mean, unsurprisingly, whether or not he was intoxicated.
Let's leave that issue aside for the moment.
Sure.
Does a trial court in that situation have the ability to find that defendant guilty of a lesser included offense?
Perhaps, but I don't believe physical control is a lesser included offense of OVI.
But I guess if we go back to the perhaps answer, let's assume for the moment that it is. I know you disagree.
Sure.
Or might disagree. Why is it still the state's right to then appeal?
In this case, I did not appeal on that issue. I appealed on whether or not the court has the power to amend a charge over the objection of the prosecutor.
Well, that gets us, okay, now we're down to what I think is the key question for me anyway. What if we simply say this wasn't an amendment? There wasn't an amendment. We look at the transcript and we say there was no amendment. We don't have to get into the question of whether a trial court can, in fact, amend a charge. We leave that for another day. But we say, looking at the transcript, we think she simply found that he was guilty of a lesser included offense. Right or wrong, that's what she did. Then what happens?
And respectfully, I don't believe how this could not be an amendment. She changed the...
Let's assume we disagree with you. And we say this is not an amendment. We don't see an amendment from the record. All we have here is a lesser included, a guilty on a lesser included offense.
Well, if
can the state appeal that?
If this court feels that what the judge did was finding him guilty upon a no contest plea of a lesser included, then perhaps I don't have a right of appeal.
Okay. Thank you.
To answer your question.
So you're saying it's permissible for the municipal judge to take a look at an Ohio Revised Code charge and then switch it to a City of Cleveland ordinance violation of a, what was it, failure to control?
Physical control, Your
Physical
Honor.
Physical control.
And that's an interesting point. When the court just inquired of the prosecutor that day, is there a revised code section for physical control generally? The prosecutor responded affirmatively, 4511.194. All of a sudden, on the journal entry, the court looks at it, that state code section is crossed out, and the city code section, 433.011, is written in.
You know
that
why?
That was never said, not once, during that hearing. That code section was never brought up by the prosecutor or by the defense attorney or by the court. It appeared on the journal entry, and the only inference that can be made is that the court did it. I mean, there was nothing.
Was that done contemporaneously with the judge sitting on the bench? Was she writing that out while she was addressing the case?
Yes, typically in municipal court, the journal entries are filled out contemporaneously with the proceedings unfolding in front of the court. That journal entry is then given to the journalizer to electronically transcribe what the court has written.
And the parties don't get a copy of that immediately to say, Judge, what's with this civil ordinance here?
No. Not at all. The copy that was obtained was when I filed the notice of leave to appeal. So, and the city's point here and what the city relied on in seeking leave to appeal was that the court, in contravention of Criminal Rule 7D, did change the name and identity of the crime charged here from one of operating a vehicle under the influence to one of physical control while under the influence.
And she did that prior to the no contest plea?
Mr. Jones's attorney changed the plea to no contest. The judge then immediately went into the findings not on the issue of physical control versus OVI, but to the other counts at which with which he was charged. It only came into account later when the prosecutor inquired, what happened here? On count one, what did the court do? On count two, what did you find? And then that's when the court explained what the court did. So the court did not change. The city's position is I don't think it matters if it happened before. Criminal Rule 7 provides, it doesn't matter if it happened before, during, and after the indictment or the trial. It matters if it changed the nature and identity or the name and identity of the crime charge, and that's what the city believes happened here.
And that is appealable.
In the city's view, yes, it is. The city was never given an opportunity to introduce or adduce any evidence to prove whether or not Mr. Jones was operating a vehicle while under the influence. There was no witnesses ever sworn in. There was no evidence introduced. Like Justice O'Donnell said, the court kind of tipped its hand when it said, you know, following two lengthy sidebars, that, you know, I'm going to hold you responsible for a couple of the charges, but one. But I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt here. So at that instance, I think that the defendant and certainly the defense counsel knew what was happening here, and they
also immediately. Did the city ever proffer any evidence at that point?
No, the city never proffered any evidence at that point.
Isn't that a waiver then?
Your Honor, to be honest here, I was the prosecutor in the municipal level, and when this all unfolded, it was extremely confusing in the record, and that's why I had a couple of pages in the record I had to clarify what was happening here, because, you know, when I told the court, you know, he can plead no contest, that's his right, he can plead no contest to the charges, or we can have a trial, then all of a sudden the defense counsel said he'll change his plea to no contest, the court immediately went into sentencing.
I will give you that. It's very confusing. But I guess what I'm looking for is just somewhere in the record where the city said, Your Honor, we're just going to note an objection here for the record. We haven't been given the opportunity to present any evidence or some sort of a proffer or a motion to the court. I'm not finding that here.
And I agree that is not in the record. The only thing that I don't know if it even would come close, but the city did say multiple times that it's not willing to amend it. Kind of a pseudo objection in that regard. So the court, upon a plea of no contest, like I indicated, the court in a misdemeanor has a limited right of what they can do when a defendant enters a no contest plea. And no contest is an admission of the truth of the facts contained in the complaint. So
but there had already been statements and testimony about what happened at the actual stop. The trooper testified and the defendant testified, did they not?
They both did, correct.
When did they do that? At the previous hearing? No, they did it at that hearing because she postponed it so that the trooper would be there.
Correct. They did. They both elicited some unsworn statements at the very beginning, at the outset of this hearing, as to the facts of what happened on that day. There was a prior hearing date that's alluded to in the record in front of you that states that the trial court didn't want to accept his plea, which he was going to enter a few weeks prior, because there's, in her words, a difference between being intoxicated and being angry. So the court, it's the city's submission that the court, in finding Mr. Jones guilty of physical control, based that finding upon facts that were extraneous to those contained in the complaint. The city's position is that, in part, she based her finding, she had to, because there's no facts in the record that support a finding of physical control versus OVI, that she based her finding upon those facts that were stated at the outset of the hearing, that he was angry that he was getting pulled over by the trooper, that he was combative, and that, you know, he had just dropped his phone, and he was just starting a job, and he thinks this is going to negatively affect his application to paramedic school. I think she took, in the city's position, is she took all those facts into account, had these two lengthy sidebars, tipped her hat as to what she was going to do, and that's when the defendant, through his counsel, entered a plea of no contest. She proceeded to find him guilty on an unrelated municipal code
section. And you think the communication to the counsel prior to the actual no contest was the amendment?
Yes, it was.
All right.
It was, and the city again refused to do it, so she did it.
Right.
The trial court did it herself. So if there are no further questions, I'd see the remainder of my time to Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I think a question that Justice O'Donnell asked and has been reiterated by several of the other justices really sums up this case. And that involves the power of the municipal court to enter a not guilty finding after a plea of no contest. And I simply disagree with my friend on the other side that Revised Code 293707 gives that the sort of power that was exercised here. If you look at State ex rel Stern v. Massico or State v. Byrd, this court has held on repeated occasions that the power to enter a no contest plea really is just the power to test the facts alleged in a charging document against the offense. Mm-hmm. And it is only assuming all facts is true if the indictment fails to allege a necessary fact that you can find someone not guilty. And so simply the judge did not have the power here to enter a not guilty finding upon the plea of no contest. She didn't have the power to enter a guilty plea finding on a lesser included.
She had the authority to enter not guilty
without an
amendment. She could have said, you know, as you said, the facts tested against the charge. Depending on what her version of the facts were, what she accepted, credibility, et cetera.
She had no power to make that sort of accepting decision or credibility decision. She must accept as true all of the facts in the charging document. And so a not guilty finding actually has to be a finding that the charging document is insufficient.
Right. The facts don't support the charge.
The facts, correct. And I believe that goes to a question that Justice Lanzinger
was... Let me just finish here. You're saying that does not allow a judge under these circumstances to find a lesser included offense the appropriate charge.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I believe that's supported by, like I said, Stern v. Massico. And Justice Lanzinger, going to your point about whether there's a final verdict, if, as Justice O'Connor suggests, the judge looked at the charging document and said there are not sufficient facts and then issued a finding of not guilty, that's really not a final verdict. It's equivalent to a dismissal of an indictment as insufficient. There's no final verdict there. There's also no double jeopardy problem. If you look to Lee v. United States and discussed again in Evans v. Michigan, if you dismiss an indictment for failure to plead an essential element, that is not a resolution of the sufficiency of the facts.
Well, how does a judge get to a lesser included municipal ordinance offense from a state charge for a higher offense?
Your Honor, at least certainly on the plea of no contest, a judge can't. If the judge feels, as in this case, that maybe there's some dispute over the facts, the option is to refuse to enter the no contest plea and set it for trial, to enter a not guilty plea and set it for trial.
But Mr. Peterson, when you look at 293707, it seems that the court has a bit broader ability because it talks about the court calling for an explanation of the circumstances of the offense from affiant, complainant, affiant or complainant's representative, et cetera. So it sounds like the court can then look at the facts to see if they do meet the standard for a finding of guilty or not guilty.
But the important thing, Your Honor, is twofold, and is that the court must accept as true all of those facts. And so really that calling of the explanation of the facts is a way to test the sufficiency of the indictment, to make sure that the state has properly charged the defendant. So it's a defendant protective requirement to ensure that the state is properly charging someone.
And let's look at this, though, in practicalities. We're talking about municipal court, traffic matters, where we have high volumes of these cases coming in. And whatever we write in this particular case is going to have to be followed by municipal judges with very heavy burdens. So what are you saying, that they cannot look at a situation like this after a no-contest plea and enter a physical control because that's what they believe the evidence shows?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that this court has already said so on multiple occasions, like I said, in State ex rel Stern and State v. Byrd. Its only option is a no-contest plea is admission of the truth of all the facts. The court has no power, a municipal court or a common pleas court has no power to question those facts, to see whether one is more reliable. Judges in those circumstances must accept as true.
And why explanation of the circumstances? Why does the statute talk about that as another step then before entering the finding?
Well, Your Honor, if you look, some of your other cases have discussed that, and they have discussed it in similar terms of they want to ensure that there's no rush to judgment, that the prosecutor has properly pled the necessary elements so that the defendant isn't pleading no contest on an insufficient indictment, and then so it allows a judge to satisfy him or herself that the indictment is sufficient. And I would make another
point. Is there finality to the judgment in this case because it has been adjudicated and the sentence has been served?
There's no finality, Your Honor. And there's no finality because, as this court has said, and I hesitate to use the term, but there's no finality in a void judgment. And I would say, even under the most narrow construction, and I would point to Justice Lansing, your dissent in State v. Simpkins, which sets forth a much more narrow conception of what is void, and that's where there's no subject matter jurisdiction or where a court acts without authority.
Could you suggest that this would be a voidable judgment in which the state did seek leave and did timely appeal?
I don't think, Your Honor, I think that there's no need to create a question about void or voidable, because in this case there would be general agreement even under a narrow interpretation of what it means to be void. If there is an absolute statutory prohibition on a judicial action, if there is a decision, multiple decisions
from
this court.
Okay, so what is the absolute statutory prohibition that you're talking about? What is that?
On doing anything other than accepting the facts alleged as true upon a no-contest plea. Once a defendant—
Is it more obvious that you cannot amend a state statute and impose guilt pursuant to a city ordinance?
Well, Your Honor, and I'll make this my last point, because I think that is a very valid question. And Justice French, you asked a question that sort of goes to the same thing, which is there is a significant dispute here about what actually occurred, whether this was amended, whether this was a not guilty finding, and if that's really the case. And my friend on the other side concedes that if it was amendment before the plea, on page 12 of his reply, concedes that there'd be no problem with this appeal. And if this really boils down to a dispute over what happened factually in these proceedings, then I would suggest there is no rule of law to be written, and the court may wish to consider dismissing as improvidently.
Counsel,
allowed.
That's exactly what I was thinking, because it seems to me writing here invites us into the thicket that the proposed rule change trying to force judges not to deal with findings of guilt to a charge other than what the facts indicate. As Justice Lanzinger indicated, this is a high-volume court, and it seems to me there is some hazard to writing anything here in that we could be handcuffing the ability of judges to have any control and handing all the control to prosecutors.
Your Honor, I don't think, because if the court were to write something, it would simply should be writing to reaffirm its prior decision. So I don't think you would be breaking any new ground to say the effect of a no-contest plea is. It would be merely applying the Stern v. Masico decision. And finally, I would add that if there is concern about some of the reasoning in the 8th District's opinion, it was a 1-1-1 opinion, it's not precedential, but if the court did choose to dismiss as improvidently allowed, it has previously said decisions below are not to be cited, and that would also be an option
for
today.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute. So do we have a difference of opinion? You think it's perfectly appropriate for a municipal judge on a no-contest plea to amend the complaint or the charge rather than, as Mr. Peterson says, the judge is limited to two courses here. Either the choice is to find guilty of the charge or not guilty.
Yes, Your Honor, we do have a difference of opinion. First,
I think they can amend.
It's again, she didn't, in our view, amend the charge. She found him guilty of a different offense.
Okay, well,
I think the question I asked you is
guilty as to the charge, not to an amended charge. You're
saying she does have that authority.
She has the ability to amend a charge.
Yes, she does have the ability to find him guilty of a lesser, and this court has held that in City of Cuyahoga Falls versus Bowers. The case cited by the state attorney general, Stern versus Masico, deals with a felony. Misdemeanors are different. There's a specific statute that applies to it. And this court in Bowers said a no contest plea may not be the basis for a finding of guilty without an explanation of circumstances. So their position is, as long as the complaint properly alleges the facts, the judge has no choice but to find the defendant guilty.
But wait a minute, you say without the explanation of circumstances, right. And you're taking that to mean then the judge can receive those circumstances and extrapolate any way they want to a lesser offense. That's the avenue you would take to get to the lesser offense.
Yes, I think that's what the law provides, is that there's no reason to give an explanation of circumstances unless the statute specifically provides the trial court the ability to find the defendant not guilty or guilty based on an explanation of the circumstances. There's no reason to put that extra language in there specifically for misdemeanors if the plea, if the charge of the complaint is enough by itself.
Well, why wouldn't it be a cautionary or an extra step so that the judge is assured that the circumstances, in other words, the facts that somebody is not contesting are what they are.
Well,
and those facts would then equate to or give rise to the charge as, and if it doesn't, then it's not guilty.
Well, that's the rule in felony cases. So if that were true, then the General Assembly wouldn't have to enact this statute that specifically provides for an explanation of circumstances in misdemeanor cases. Moreover, this court in City of Bowers was very clear, City of Cuyahoga Falls versus Bowers, that we're talking about, you can't just in a perfunctory fashion find the defendant guilty based on a no contest plea, again, in a misdemeanor case. This is a different situation. You have to consider the circumstances. That's what this judge did here. There's
is that just a nod to the type of clients that come into municipal court that oftentimes they're uncounseled, often more so than in the general division? Oftentimes they just want to go in and get something over with, and this is the mechanism that's built into the system to assure at least a level of understanding on behalf of the defendant?
I don't think so. This court, again, in Bowers, said it's a substantive right that involves a finding of guilt based on explanation, or not guilt, based on an explanation of the circumstances. I think it's more than just you providing, you know, making sure that the charge really alleges the facts.
Mr. Sweeney, what is the Bowers site, please? It doesn't seem to be in your brief.
Your Honor, it's 9 Ohio State 3rd, 148.
148?
Yes. And the one thing
Mr. Sweeney, before you leave that, you're suggesting that the Bowers case stands for the proposition a trial court can't just take a no contest and say, okay, you're guilty, right?
Correct.
You're saying that.
Yes.
Because that protects the rights of the defendant, correct?
Correct.
What about the rights of the state? Isn't that what happened here?
Well,
The trial court took the no contest and said, okay, you're not guilty. Isn't that what they did?
And that's what happens across the state of Ohio regularly in bench trials, in jury trials, in cases involving no contest pleas like this one, where the state disagrees with the outcome. But that doesn't give them, they have different rights than the defendant. They have lesser rights in terms of appeals.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.